zoom there. Aha. Uh-huh. Characters. That's for sure. Characters. Okay.
The four thoughts that turn the mind from samsara. Da da ji da jo dan zan ti. Chine yang yang ne ka we. Da re la me kun zan vi. Go pan du te shan dun cha. Da te ren jen lu di yang. Chi da du ki dra dung we. Nam chi. As this excellent body of mind with leisure and endowments will be difficult to obtain repeatedly in the future, right now we will accomplish the state of the unsurpassed Samantabhadra to meaningfully benefit others. Also, it is not certain when the hateful enemy of this present precious body, the Mara of death, will arrive. I and other beings are impermanent, the time of death being uncertain. Since there is no opportunity for happiness wherever one is born in samsara, and since a happy existence was never seen, we will enter the path of nirvana. In order for this body with leisure and wealth to possess meaning, we will abandon the three non-virtuous poisonous afflictions, develop diligence in virtuous actions, protect the vows and commitments of the three doors. Going for refuge. Namo Dashan Nam Ka Nam Pe Sanchanam Du Din Is Ola Me Jam Chupa Chila Kham Jola Mala Japchi Nam Jojo Soli Dam La Japchi Bajo Kansa Kham Jola Japchi Kyanne sowa sanje la japchi Shiwe jandra dem jo la japchi So gishin jo gandan la japchi Trinle nada chokyan la japchi
Namo, from now until the attainment of unsurpassed awakening, I and all other sentient beings equal to space go for refuge to the Guru, the source of all blessings. We go for refuge to the Adam, bestower of Supreme City. We go for refuge to the Dakini, dispeller of all obstacles. We go for refuge to the Buddha, the first among humans. We go for refuge to the Sublime Dharma, peaceful and free from attachment. We go for refuge to the Sangha, the supreme field of accumulation. We go for refuge to the Dhammapalas, masters of activity. Namo, for now until the attainment of unsurpassed awakening, I and all living sentient beings equal to space, go for refuge to the Gurus, source of all blessings. We go for refuge to the Adam, bestower of supreme city. We go for refuge to the Dakini, dispeller of all obstacles. We go for refuge to the Buddha, the first among humans. We go for refuge to the Sublime Dharma, peaceful and free from attachment. We go for refuge to the Sangha, the supreme field of accumulation. We go for refuge to the Dharmapalas, masters of activity. Generating bodhicitta. Kor korwe sen chen du dal dun dal shen. Deva chola nyam pa ne laga Kan la tan yon nyam pe sam chodi Chan chu ning po Cicero Saldorge Nimpolam, Lame Judira Lesum Parli.
May all sentient beings of samsara be free from suffering, be joyful, and truly abide in supreme happiness. We generate the supreme mind impartial towards all in order to attain the heart of awakening. In order that we may fully benefit the beings of the six realms, we must attain to the stage of Buddhahood in this very lifetime. Therefore, we will be very diligent in these unsurpassed teachings, the path of the luminously clear Vajra essence. May all sentient beings of samsara be free from suffering, be joyful and truly abide in supreme happiness. We generate the supreme mind impartial towards all, in order to attain the heart of awakening. In order that we may fully benefit the beings of the six realms, we must attain to the stage of Buddhahood in this very lifetime. Therefore, we will be very diligent in these unsurpassed teachings, the path of the luminously clear Vajra essence. Vajrasattva.
Satta Samaya Manupamaya Benza Satta Teno Patishta Drito Me Bawa Sutokaya Me Bawa Supokaya Me Bawa Anurakta Me Bawa Sava Siddhi Me Prayacha Sava Kama Sucha Me Chitam Shriyam Guru Om Ahahaho Bhagavan Sarva Tathagata Vendra Mame Mucha Vendra Bhava Mahasamaya Sato Om Vendra Sato Samaya Manupalaya Vendra Sato Teno Patishto Drita Me Bhava Sutokaya Me Bhava Supokaya Me Bhava Anurakta me bhava sava siddhi me prayacha sava kama sucha me chitam shriyam kuru om Ahahaho Bhagavan sava tathagata vendra mame mucha vendra bhava mahasamaya sato Om Vendra Sata Samaya Manipalaya Vendra Sato Teno Patishta Drito Me Bawa Sutokaya Me Bawa Supokaya Me Bawa Anurakta Me Bawa Sava Siddhi Me Praya Sava Karma Sucha Me Chitam Shriyam Kuru Om Ahahaho Bhagavan Sava Tathagata Vendra Mame Musha Vendra Bawa
visualized Buddha field, may all migrating beings take birth in a pure Buddha field. Om Guru Deva Dakini Ratna Mandala Praticha Swaha. Guru Yoga. Om Ah Om.
Ram Re Kada Zinkam Su Ram Daga. own vibrant energy, the root guru, to whom we supplicate with a devoted mind, bless us to accomplish the rainbow body. Om, ah, om. In the Buddha field of one's own originally pure awareness, in the palace of unceasing inner radiance, is one's own vibrant energy, the root guru, to whom we supplicate with a devoted mind, bless us to accomplish the rainbow body.
So, a few administrative details. Someone wants to record these down, or you can make a note of these. Tonight, I'll come back and lead the Dorje Drolo meditation and some teaching on the 12 tantric root vows, or sometimes they're called the downfalls, and they're very important. So that is tonight, Dorje Drolo meditation. And then I think it's great for you to, for all of us to have the opportunity to have Tuesday and Wednesday free to practice, okay, and to have an evening meditations led as well. So I'm not sure who will do that, but we'll see. On Tuesday and Wednesday, they're full practice days of Dorje Drolo, or whatever meditation you're doing. It may not be exactly Dorje Drolo, but perhaps it is. And then Thursday morning is the Bodhicitta Vivarana. Friday morning, also the Bodhicitta Vivarana. That will end the 112 verses. There'll be a transmission probably on Friday of the loving kindness, classic Theravada loving kindness meditation, and the preliminary liberating instructions, the transmission for that, as well as in the evening Dorje Drolo practice on the 8th and the 9th, the Thursday and Friday. Saturday morning, possibly depending on some scheduling things, there will be a good question. Maybe the reading transmission of the Yangtze plus explanations on the 10th. And then on the 11th, which is the anniversary of Rinpoche's birthday, and an auspicious day, will be a Dzogchen transmission from Guru Rinpoche, as requested by Travis. In the evening, between 7 and 7:30, there will be the refuge ceremony. Someone has requested it. For a number of years, I actually finally gotten around to doing it, for refuge and the precepts and the Bodhisattva commitments at between 7 and 7:30 p.m. And then on Monday, the 12th, there's a fire puja, Nyingma Dorje's fire puja for ending retreats, the spreading of Melody Massey's ashes in the afternoon, it's a Dakini day, and 13 is the finish of it, of the retreat, probably Tuesday morning, fairly early, maybe 9 o'clock, will be the, how I usually finish a retreat, will be the Buddha's teaching on blessings, the Mangala Sutta. That's the schedule at the moment. Okay. So, yeah, finally this morning, actually both of us realizing it's time to make a schedule. Okay, back to the Bodhicitta Vivarana, and that's where we're at. Was that too quick for people? I will pass that schedule on to Mary and Shalane, if you want. And then that can be posted somewhere for people. How's that sound? Is that okay? Ariel, yes? Answer is yes to your note. Yes.
Yes, I should make an interview?
Yes.
Okay.
That could be after lunch today.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you.
63, page 7. Now, the advantage of the hot water tea cozy, the secondary advantage is that once you use it, you can put it on your head and it's warm. All monasteries in cold environments should note that. All right. 63, in brief, from empty phenomena, arise. Agent, karma, fruits, and their enjoyer, the conqueror, the Buddha, taught these to be only conventional. So, again, we've been over this many, many times. Empty phenomena, arise as empty phenomena, and cease as empty phenomena. In that way, there is no arising or ceasing. But, however, you need to experience this. And it's not something that you can intellectually work on it, but eventually it has to dawn or meet you face to face. It will. If you work on it and you keep contemplating it one day, it doesn't matter where you are, how you are, it will just suddenly dawn. It may be in retreat, it may not be. Here he's also in these next verses he's going to point out that there's nothing wrong with the conventional. It's very, very important. Don't dismiss the conventional. This is extremely important. 64. Just because the conventional doesn't exist doesn't mean it doesn't happen and affect beings. Really important. 64. Just as the sound of a drum, as well as a shoot, are produced from a collection of factors, that is interdependent origination, which is way more complex than the 12 interdependent links. Did you have a good class on that? Yeah, good go?
Yes.
Great. So the model is very linear. In the seventh book of the Abhidhamma, the Buddha expounded the Patana, which is basically interdependent causality, causal relations, which has 24 links, but they're not linear. They're all interdependent, which makes something about a trillion possibilities for every arising. That's more like reality. More like relative reality happening is possibly something like a trillion, or I think the number was, it might be 300 billion or 700 billion causal interrelations for any single given arising. But however, when it comes to both everyday life and excellent meditative abilities, we only need the three first important causal factors for most of what we do, and the three most important resultant probabilities. Does that make sense to everybody? The reason being is it's from the first three that you can usually determine the outcome of most events. However, life is way more complex than that. But and then I want to come to another point I wanted to make this morning, is when it comes to determining realization and true Dharma experience, the reason why causality is so utterly important is that the actual true measure of liberation, you can have 100,000 mystical experiences. They can be amazing. You can have the most amazing insight experiences. But unless greed, hatred, delusion, pride, and jealousy are transformed and liberated and become useful for the liberation of other beings, the experiences are not a measure of awakening. They should, but they're not always. So I just want to put that caution. From the standpoint of traditional Dharma for last 2,500 years, the real measure of success in Dharma is the downgoing, not necessarily a sudden downgoing, the gradual or sudden, gradual, slow, diminishment of greed, hatred, delusion, and especially pride and jealousy, but delusion is the key, going down, and from that will come greater and greater freedom and love. Of course, the most direct way is through the unity of compassion and emptiness, or bodhicitta. So just as a drum as well as a shoot, that is a seedling, are produced from a collection of factors, many factors, we accept the external world of dependent origination to be like a dream and illusion. He's repeating himself, but he wants to make the point really clear there. 65, that phenomena, experience, are born from causes, can never be inconsistent with facts, or can never be inconsistent, since the cause is empty of cause. We understand it to be empty of origination. So he's basically said, there's relative, it kind of works, but it's an illusion. And there is the empty perspective, where there's no origination, and there's no cause. So most people, even Buddhists, they have a very, very difficult time with this. It's either this way or that way. But actually, it's happening together. That's the hard part. It's actually happening together. It may be happening, there's beings in this room, but actually only dreamlike beings, and they have no inherent characteristics at the same time. And that's actually freedom, whereas the other would not be freedom. If it was completely empty, there'd be no liberation. If it was only causes, there'd be no liberation. But because the two-in-one truth of Dharma, that there is relative and absolute at the same time, then there is freedom, there's liberation. 66, the non-origination of all phenomena, the unborn, is clearly taught to be emptiness. In brief, the five aggregates, the five heat, the five skandhas, are denoted by the expression all phenomena. This is a beautiful expression that will eventually come up, I hope, in insight practice, that one eventually experiences all experience, no matter what it is, as simply the movement around the five heaps. So if one was to take a bundle, here we go, here's a good display. Here's a heap of five candies. And all of our experience, self and others, is the movement and strength and combination of the bubbling away of these five. But we don't see that. We see something that's way richer in the field of experience. But when we come to, especially through the Burmese Thai systems of Vipassana, especially in the tradition of Mahasaya and so on, then we're looking at the movement of these skandhas and seeing it's actually free of self, but also we're seeing that everything that we see, visual, hearing, auditory, is the play of the five skandhas. Just like you can say that if from a tantric perspective, a tantric medical perspective, all experience is the play of the five pranas, five skandhas, five pranas, five Buddha wisdoms. Getting the interrelationship? All this is rainbow light. There's nothing but rainbow light here. What's that? Just primordial rainbow light with causes and conditions and dreaming minds making up this experience. Then you'll say, but isn't this experience real? Isn't there a reality? Yeah, it's okay. But don't think that the human being is having the real experience. This is preposterous. To say that a human being is having the real experience is crazy. How about ants? How about worms? How about giraffes? How about spiders? I mean, that's probably one of the best proofs that there is no actual real experience taking place. It's just simply go through the animal... animal, non-animal, animal, prokaryotic, eukaryotic, archaea, kingdoms of life, and find out that all these different kingdoms and creatures, beings, are all experiencing this universe of possibilities, a myriad experience, very, very differently than we do. Even human beings experience this world very, very differently, right? Politically, they see the world differently. Economically, they see the world differently. Culturally, see the world very differently. 66, the non-origination of all phenomena is clearly taught to be emptiness. In brief, the five aggregates are denoted by the expression all phenomena. The movement of the five aggregates, how we experience them, is the experience of all phenomena. 67, and of course the five aggregates are empty of any ultimate substance or entityness. 67, when the ultimate truth is explained as it is, the conventional is not obstructed. This you should frame. This is kind of like encapsulate. This is so hard for people to understand in Buddhist circles and in other places. They just go nuts over this point. Even in Buddhist debates, people go crazy over this point. No, it's got to be this way or this way. And you get practitioners going like this, you know, trying to see some altered reality, which is the reality, when in fact the conventional reality is empty. It's okay. So if you're awakened, you still need to be able to drop a pen on the floor. I mean, make a cup of tea. Or read a book. So it is said that the great Jitsum Sungon, the founder of the Drikun Kagyu tradition in the 800 years ago, 835 now, I don't know, but 800 years ago, it is said that even though he was a fully awakened being, that was the Karmapa visiting Jitsum Sungon saying, this is a fully awakened being, folks. He was always carrying Dharma texts, always reading Dharma texts. Always studying, reading, practicing. So, the conventional is not obstructed. Independent of conventional, no ultimate truth can be found. In other words, never make emptiness separate from the conventional. This is the key. This means you're on the right track. As soon as you're saying, oh, this is all empty, oh, master, this is all empty, there's nothing here, it has no origination, wrong, because when you get hit by the Zen stick, you can feel it. That's a classic one, you know, the Zen student who's been practicing comes before the Zen master, and Zen master says, yes, yes, I have found it, excellent, whack, what about now? So the student goes running out. 68, the conventional is taught to be emptiness. The emptiness itself is the conventional. That's why people get caught up and say, yeah, but I don't want to do visualizations. I don't want to say endless mantras. I don't want to do that. I just want to reside in emptiness. Error, error, as Data would say, error, error, error. Big mistake, wrong, wrong view, gone wrong. Time for a re-education program. Go back to Buddhist school, go meditate, go find a teacher. This is classic. This is just classic. You have to be absolutely easy with all the forms and appearances as the nature of emptiness, conventional and empty, absolutely simultaneous. One does not occur without the other, just as being produced, produced and impermanent. So there is impermanence, but there's no beings being impermanent. There is impermanent, but there's no actual forms undergoing impermanence. And there are beings being produced, born right now, yes? Conceived and born. And by the way, conceived, interesting enough, not evenly distributed throughout the year. A lot of people get born in September. I wonder why. Anyways.
Long winter.
Long winter. but how about in Central America, Caribbean? What would you say?
I have no idea.
Ah, so you have to look up the stats. South America, New Zealand, Australia? Different. Okay. So anyways, there's beings being produced, except that they're empty as well. 69, the conventional arises from afflictions and karma. And karma rises from the mind. This frame this. Put this on your refrigerator. Put it on a magnet, fridge magnet. Karma rises from the mind. You may say, oh, I don't feel very well today. Oh, this and that. But in fact, how you experience it, we're all going to be subject to cause and conditions. How we experience it, what we do with it, is the key. This is our mind. The mind is accumulated by the propensities, the relative mind. Please put in there, the relative mind is accumulated by the propensities, by the volitional constructs, and not your volitional constructs. All human beings, all sentient beings, have the same propensities, which is some cultural variations, strange, interesting cultural variations. When free from propensities, it's happiness. That means free of clinging. When there's actually true free of clinging, that is the natural happiness, because it's not relying on anything. It's just free. This is the key, really one of the key pith instructions I can give you, is experience it again and again. When the clinging ceases, the pristine awareness instantly arises. You have to see that. So there's really two key points about liberation. How you're doing. When you want to ask how you're doing, is the diminishment of greed, hatred, delusion, pride, and jealousy, the five poisons, and the upgoing of generosity, loving kindness, especially compassion, and non-delusion and wisdom. And secondly, more and more moments of natural non-clinging awareness, which is also fruition consciousness, but more and more natural moments by which one knows that there hasn't been attachment and clinging. Even if one is still involved in the conventional, you actually know that the formations are not caught up in producing more formations. Yeah. In other words, you can build a building, but there isn't the attachment of emotional investment. It's for the good. It's for everybody's good. But I'll give you an example. It could be that you live in a palace or a mansion. Yeah, and you have the ability financially to eat scrumptious, excellent, wonderful food. That means you can shop at Whole Foods all the time, which is quite expensive, but you can shop at Whole Foods all the time, no problem. But you can also go into a very simple retreat situation the next day or anytime and enjoy rice and a bit of scrambled eggs and some stir fry. And there's no problem at all. So, two in one.
Oliver, can you say more about that those moments of non-clinging awareness are fruition moments?
Yes, if they're genuine non-clinging, then there's been a time where there was the real experience, the real genuine experience of non-clinging, freedom, Logudra. And therefore now, they're going to have fruition moments where, quite naturally, walking along, doing something, saying something, and you can experience the same nibbana quality, that there's no being hanging on to anything, and there's no fixity at all. And yet, out of your mouth or out of your actions is coming a karma, and yet there's no clinging to that karma. This is crucial. So therefore, you know it's being released. But others will see it as production, building a temple, building a life, building a house, saying that you want a certain food, you'd like it a certain way, taking the purb out and, you know, getting tough with beings, or peaceful, or meditating, or not meditating, whatever it is, taking action. But in that is a mind that feels completely unbound and no location, no fixation at all at the same time. So therefore, the conventional is operating, but the activity is for Buddha activity. It's for freeing, not for confining, or for the production of Dharma. So, for instance, why would we rebuild the temple? What for? Just let it rot. Build another one, right? It's easy. But for the benefit of beings, relative, and for the benefit of the expounding of the Dharma and people doing retreats, you know, therefore, we do things for the benefit of beings. You know, it might be building a house, it may be serving a beautiful meal. Do you see? Someone say, why are you buying truffles? It's expensive. Why would you buy truffles? To introduce people to exploration, to discovery, to possibilities and wonder, which is also empty. I remember many, many years ago, my first year with Namjoon Rinpoche, I had a beautiful experience. I'll never forget it. Is there was something going on that day where we had to plan a boat trip. In those days, there's no online. We carried around what was called the ABC Guide of Freighters. It's a book about this thick, had all the freighter schedules for the world that has passenger freighter schedule. And that was Namjoon Rinpoche's book of how he got around the world. It was very complex to figure this out, all the possibilities. You had to go back and forth and cross-link and all this. And I remember we had been discussing it, and then Namjoon Rinpoche, that late morning on the island of Crete, I remember this, he gave the Mahamaya empowerment. Beautiful. The Mahamaya empowerment. And I remember right after the empowerment, like as soon as it stopped, like the last prayer, the last bit, it was, and right into the ABC travel guide discussion. At the last moment, there was like almost no transition. He wasn't thinking about it, just like, do. And I went, whoa, what a mind. Because you see, he's in profound, profound liberative awareness. And then it's just about the travel, about that schedule. Now, how do we get from, you know, Papua New Guinea to such and such? Can you look that up? And it was just beautiful because it was seamless. There was a quality of no broken awareness. It was just simply the same nature. And I remember that was so important for me to see, to experience. Just no difference whatsoever. Beautiful. So that was a very important non-instruction, since I had to go get the ABC guide. So when free from propensities, when it's free from generating more karma, it's happiness. This is happy. And this happiness doesn't arise from anything in particular except the space of freedom. Absolute, utter, knowing freedom. And of course then, if it's with bodhicitta, it is knowing freedom and knowing that beings are liberated in the space of that freedom, whether it's conventional or not. 70. A happy mind is tranquil indeed, even if it's Dorje Drolo. Even if it's Dorje Drolo, that's a happy mind. It's happy seeing beings liberated. The mind's happy. Just because the outer expression doesn't look happy, the mind's happy. Of course. There's gurus that are fierce a lot of time, eh? Fierce gurus, they're fierce. They take no prisoners as students. Poor students. And then there's peaceful teachers. They're always so peaceful, just so sweet and peaceful. And there's teachers who are every disposition in between. Depending on the propensity of students, right? Teachers also are interdependent with the propensity of the students that come to them. I've seen teachers who've said, yeah, you know, Lama Mark, your students are very different than the ones that come to see me? Why have different karmic propensities? So a happy mind is tranquil indeed. A tranquil mind is not confused. That's why it's very happy. It just sees things so clearly. But conventionally, yeah, things may go this way or that way. You know? But not confused. To have no confusion about the nature of emptiness and bodhicitta is to understand the truth. By understanding the truth, one attains freedom. Very straightforward. So the path of freedom is less and less confusion. There should be less and less and less confusion. Not to say that life is perfect and you'll always figure things out. You can't. It's too complicated. That's not the important part. You can just put your hands up sometimes. But your perspective of Dharma and seeing what Dharma actually is, that's unchanging. It doesn't matter what's happening in your life. You know, some of the greatest teachers have had their lives just fall apart. Health, thrown out of country, right? Running for their lives, whatever it is. Great, great masters. But yet what they did for beings and their ability to continue with expounding the Dharma or unfolding is fantastic. Just breathtaking. Yeah. Seventy-one. It is described as suchness, and as the reality limit, as signless, and as the ultimate truth, as the supreme awakening mind, that is the supreme bodhicitta. It's described also as the emptiness. So this is where he's trying to rub out this idea. He's just going to kind of really grind this idea that shunyata and emptiness is empty. Shunyata and empty is anything but empty. It's absolutely full of great love and conventionally removing afflictions and freeing beings in a scope where they're already free. The more you know that beings are already free, the more you can enter into the conventionality and untie the knots. Does it make sense? If you don't know that, you don't really know they're primordially free, then you're always trying to do techniques to get them free. But actually, within any technique or anything at all, any activity, you can help people unbind, visibly or invisibly. 72, those who do not understand emptiness are not receptive vehicle, and are not a receptive vehicle for liberation. Such ignorant beings will revolve in the existence prison of six classes of beings. So this may sound like harsh words, but if you're not learning and understanding about emptiness, even conventionally, or in any way that you're trying to frame it, then you're really not understanding Dharma. And the word the Dalai Lama, because I heard this directly from him sitting in the audience, beautiful talk he gave before an empowerment of Chakrasamvara in India. I'll never forget this. It was something like this. I'm pretty sure I have. It doesn't really matter if the words are right, but I never forgot it because it was so powerful moment. He said to the entire audience of probably, I don't know, maybe 2,000, 1,000 people. It wasn't that big. It didn't matter. But he said, even if you have a rosary, even if you have a robe, even if you practice deity yoga, you don't understand emptiness, you're not a Buddhist. And I went, oh my God, he's going to get killed. He's going to get shot. Is he brave or what? You know, and flanking him are two Indian military officers with guns. Because someone could easily kill the Dalai Lama, right? But I thought, what a brave man in front of a whole group of Tibetan and Western, not very many Westerners, but mostly Tibetans, to simply say that whatever accoutrements of Dharma you have, even your meditative practice, if you don't understand emptiness, you're not a Buddhist. What? Is he brave? Well, as a great master of Nargujuna, the Dalai Lama, that's also what Nargujuna is saying. To be a Buddhist means you really understand emptiness, but not empty as nihilism, empty as full of liberative power. Dorje Drulo, Chenrezig. Okay. Those who do not understand emptiness are not a receptive vehicle for liberation. Such ignorant beings will revolve in the existence prison, samsara, of six classes of beings. It's profound. That's another one for refrigerator magnet. 73. When this emptiness, as explained, is thus meditated upon by yogis, by male and female practitioners, which is what's called yoga. So in the tradition of Buddhist India, Buddhist India and Buddhist Tibet, what is called a yogi or a yogini is someone who is pursuing and fairly accomplished in the nature of emptiness and compassion, bodhicitta. So the practices of yoga, of hatha yoga, no matter how good one is of that, from the tradition of Buddha Dharma, of ancient India and of Tibet, a naljorma or a naljor pa is considered someone who is practicing mind training towards full liberation, towards full bodhicitta, and that's called yoga. Or the meditation of Gom. But the importance of hatha yogas or sa lung meditations are most of the attained beings, especially some of the greatest teachers, have all practiced hatha yoga as a means to control and open the channels, the winds and drops. So this is important. For instance, Rinchen Puntsog, the founder of the Drikon, is said to have been a great yoga practitioner of Jabir. And Jabir was a famous Sufi practitioner. The Buddhists recognized as a great Buddhist yogin, attained Buddhist yogin, who had an entire system of physical, mental visualization practices, which are part of the Yangtze tradition back from India. So when this emptiness is, as explained, is thus meditated upon by yogis, no doubt there will rise in them a sentiment attached to others' welfare. Aha, now we're starting into bodhicitta. All right? So it's not just the line, you have to be careful. When this emptiness, not this nihilism, when this emptiness as explained is thus meditated, as explained, as directed, no doubt there will arise in them a sentiment, a feeling, a wish attached to others' welfare. Mm-hmm. Any questions so far? Anything? Nothing, eh? All straightforward? I told you it'd be a little more straightforward here on in. 74, towards those beings that have bestowed benefits upon me in the past, such as through being my parents or friends, I shall strive to repay their kindness. Ah, beautiful. This is realizing that all of us, if you reflect on the negative of parents and friends, then you see the world from a negative standpoint of they did it to me. But if you see all sentient beings as afflicted by parents and friends and colleagues and teachers and whoever it is. Then you come up to a different place, which is we're all in this together. We're all conflicted. Short of full Buddhahood, we all have afflictions. We're all this is called part of life. And then you see that these friends and parents have been trying their best. They've really been trying their best. You know, I've never been a parent. But knowing some parents, like Laurel and my parents and others, there's other parents, I think, yes, in the room, I know that they've tried their genuine best. They've really tried to help their children grow in the best possible way they can. And is it always perfect? No, it can't be. And actually in life, it can't be. It's too complex. So, but they have tried. So their kindness of trying to raise the best children and grow them and feed them and school them and do whatever they can for them, that is what needs to be focused on, that we live in a world, really, even among amoebas and bacteria and protozoas and fungi, especially yeast. I can tell you about that, but anyways, yeast. Fish. Many creatures are, it turns out from 30 years, 40 years of biological studies, incontrovertible, they're basically altruistic creatures. Most beings do things for the benefit of others. And there's not that many that are actively engaged, even though we think of it from the news media, there's not that many that are actively engaged in destruction and the putting down and the evil machinations to destroy beings and ruin their lives. There's not that actual many, although they may take power because they're nuts and they have the guts to do so and people want them to. But actually, most people, given a chance, are really kind and altruistic. Just because the leaders of a country do something nasty, the villagers are absolutely glorious. Just because there were in the time of Nazi Germany, there were many Nazis, and the country was quite diabolical. There's so many stories of Germans, even Nazi Germans, who protected Jews and others and safeguard their lives to the detriment or to the possible execution of their life. So most beings are very kind. Most beings try to be kind, including bacteria. That's why we get plaque on our teeth. That's called kindness. There's a bunch of bacteria that are protecting the other bacteria and safeguarding them. Because when you brush your teeth, you're wiping off the plaque, but actually, you're wiping off the protectors. There's a whole layer of bacteria that's still staying on. If you take antibiotics, same thing happens. There's bacteria that take the antibiotic and die, but there's also bacteria that are left and don't get affected by the bacteria. And of course, there's bacteria that are really good at mutating, which means within a short time, they've gotten around the antibiotic really fast. You know? So many, many mothers and fathers will give up their lives for their children immediately. 75, to those beings that are being scorched by the fire of afflictions in existence's prison, just as I have given them sufferings in the past, it's befitting today that I give them happiness. So this is the kernel of loving kindness practice in the northern schools. Also in the southern schools, but mostly in the northern schools, this attitude towards mothers, fathers, and friends, and so on, as being beings of kindness, I'm repaying their kindness because they made me who I am today. And you may say, well, I'm in bad shape. I'm a baddie. I'm really not in good shape. They ruined my lives. But actually, most of those people who are saying that have actually a lot of potential, a lot of good stuff happening. They just can't see it. From the standpoint of Abhidhamma teaching, Theravada and Abhidhamma teaching, all states, every state that any state that any being has, has loving kindness already in it, has kindness. You can't function, I mean, sorry, as a majority. You couldn't function all day long in a negative place. You'd be dead very quickly. So actually, most of what we have going on, even though we may not see that, is pretty awesome, pretty extraordinary.
Would you say that even greed, hatred, delusion are even forms of loving kindness?
Ultimately, from the standpoint of what's really happening, the delusion, the greed, the hatred, delusion, is in fact manifestations of profound love for liberation, but just confused how to do it. So if someone comes up and punches you, they want to be happy. They just don't know how to be happy. If a virus or bacteria takes your life, it just wants to be eating and happy and reproduce. It just doesn't know how to leave you alone. Does that make sense? A president, a prime minister, a governor, a minister, politician, perhaps a person in power who is diabolical and twisted, is really trying to be happy. They just don't know how to be happy for the welfare of others. Does it make sense? So in that sense, yes. It's Buddha nature. It's just twisted Buddha nature. I mean, if you take a pane of glass and the pane of glass is glass. And glass, by the way, with a refractive index of 1.5, is pretty transparent to light, eh? Really good glass? I don't know if you've ever seen really great glass. But take something like an Italian mirror, or a mirror made, let's say, by Corning or other companies that make incredibly clear, outstanding glass. I don't know if you've ever seen it, but it's breathtaking to look at. Have you ever seen that? Maybe some of you have. It's absolutely breathtaking. When you look at really clear glass, it really is like, whoa. Because most of the glass we get isn't that clear. It's okay, it's commercial glass. All right? So you can get glass that is really poor quality, and you can get glass that's really high quality. The process of manufacturing of glass, all the way from the collecting of the minerals, to the sorting, to the heating, to the furnace and air, all the way through gives distortion, less distortion or more distortion. So really you can look at consciousness as the same material, Buddha nature, just more distorted or less distorted. That's all. But it's doing the same thing. It just wants to be happy. It wants to be free. All beings want to be free and happy. So somebody who, for instance, to give an example, and it's crazy, but it's just because I saw a show on it, it was pretty cool. Just because someone collect super yachts, you know, $500 million, $700 billion, $1 billion super yachts, and that's their life. That makes them happy. Yeah, they're doing the same thing that someone else is doing, who's, I don't know, going out there and collecting minerals, or someone who's into good coffees, or someone who, I don't know, collects houses, or someone who collects makes beautiful shrines. You see what I mean? It's the same thing. They want freedom and sustained happiness. It's just a question of the expression. And everybody should be praying for Donald Trump. Everybody should be praying for dictators so that their minds become free and clear and they become liberated. They may have to go to prison. I'm not saying Donald Trump, but they may have to go to prison. It might be most compassionate for beings if they stopped what they're doing and perhaps got arrested or their power taken away. But at the same time, we wish them liberation and happiness, because that's what they're trying to do. They're just twisted. They're very unhappy. So we also have to realize how much suffering we give other beings. Short of full Buddhahood, we're stepping on people's toes, we're preventing them from liberating, we're doing all kinds of crazy things. And we have to understand that it's not just them, but us and in previous lifetimes, we or whoever that was not we, but whoever that manifestation was probably a mass murderer. You should face that, you know, if you really understand rebirth. At some point, any of our streams of being were mass murderers, were killers. We've killed, we've maimed, we've stolen, we've done all those things. We've all broken the precepts in previous existences. Yeah? And here we are saying, I'm so pure, right? I'm so high and mighty. But no, actually, we've all of us, all of our connections, not us, all of our connections have done some really bad stuff in the past. So we should give everybody the opportunity for happiness and liberation. 76, the fruits which are desirable or undesirable in the form of fortunate or unfortunate births in the world, they come about from helping the sentient beings or harming them. So this is called cause and effect. Who we are is dependent on merit and virtue. Now, you may say, come on, this is kind of primitive. In other words, if I do good actions this lifetime, I'll get a good rebirth. I'll get a good rebirth. And I'll reap the benefits of my fruitions. In a sense, yes, in a sense, of course, it's not going to be you. But what an amazing gift in terms of talent, qualities, goodness, all kinds of things, to know that there is no discontinuity of karmic formations in the pool of karmic formations. If you have the perspective of perfecting your finest human qualities and attributes, awakening qualities in this lifetime, isn't that an amazing gift to give others in future lifetimes? Isn't that fantastic? I don't know if you have that sense. I certainly do. It's just great. Everything we do right now is for the next being tomorrow. You're not the same being tomorrow. And you're not the next same being next week. And after death, it's not the same being, but it has a profound connection to your formations. So what an amazing gift you can give to your offspring, in a sense, your clones. Your tomorrow clone, next week clone, after death clone, future lifetime clones, by perfecting, by developing, by completing the most beautiful qualities of the path, so that other beings prosper, not just your friends, not just your Dharma students, not just your relatives and so on, but actually a vast array of beings in the future will benefit by what you do today. If you can see that, it's glorious. It's really glorious. I believe there was a question over there. Yes.
I was just gonna ask for clarification because I was wondering. Let me use my words. you're saying so if you do positive actions for yourself, you are setting your future self, which literally isn't you, but you're literally setting yourself up to experience more abundance.
Both relative and absolute. That doesn't mean that the future being won't be born poor, but the abilities and the potential could be quite astounding.
You're building merit and you're
building power and building excellent qualities for not just liberation, but actually the ability to help countless sentient beings. Yeah, powerful karmic being. As all of you are, actually, you're all extremely well gifted and endowed by karma to not just be here, but all of your lives are, even your young lives are extraordinary. I mean, just to be born in Toronto or raised in Toronto and go to school in Toronto and have reasonably healthy parents and so on and good health in a absolutely socialist country. I mean, we're not called a socialist country, but from the point of view of some Chinese I've met, we're way more socialist. Extraordinary place to be born. So the potential is amazing. So they come about, number 76, they come about from primarily from helping the sentient beings or harming them. So even if you go into retreat for the next 10 years and you're really practicing bodhicitta, relative and ultimate bodhicitta, and no one ever sees you for 10 years, your impact on the world will likely be absolutely extraordinary, even if you only teach one being, or teach two or three, or 1,000, or 1,000,000. Your impact in the world will be incredible, because your power, your merit base to affect change in beings will be breathtaking. Like a Kenzi Rinpoche, like the last, His Holiness Diglo Kenzi Rinpoche is a good example. A Kala Rinpoche, Namja Rinpoche, Dalai Lama. Kenzi Rinpoche, I believe, spent 14 years in pretty much solitary retreat on top of a mountain. But when he came down, he was unstoppable. The Karmapa, 16 Karmapa, unstoppable. Namja Rinpoche, unstoppable. And these beings were great contemplatives and great yogis, who traversed the world liberating beings. Some, just a few, like Namja Rinpoche, not very many, actually, relative to many other teachers. And others, hundreds of thousands of beings. So the force of great merit and great realization of emptiness is, bodhicitta, is really something else. And this is for the benefit of sentient beings. Okay. So we're deep in the heart of bodhicitta now. 77-78. So I will come to a common refrain, which I say quite often. It may sound a bit repetitive, but our default mode is usually to protect ourselves and take the self-protective self. What's the word? Self-building mode as our normal reaction to when we feel we need something, whether we need pleasure or we need relief or we need growth, right? But to include all beings, as trained, include all beings in that, and to go, I'm going to school for all beings. I'm going to the Dharma Center for all beings. I'm going to renovate a temple for all beings. I'm going to clean up the yard for all beings. I'm going to clean up the kitchen for all beings. When you really see that that's really what it's about, then the karmic merit, the merit that you build for other beings, just keeps magnifying. But our default position for some of us, because it's not part of our society and culture, is to do things for ourselves. All right. Number 77-78. If by relying upon the sentient beings, the unexcelled state of Buddhahood is brought about. What does that mean, relying? The interdependence of sentient beings and extracting their good qualities. That's what it is. Which is another way of saying, just surround yourself with the wisest beings and intelligent beings and learn and grow. And grow in Dharma. All right? By relying on the best of sentient beings. By relying on the Buddha nature of sentient beings. By relying on the virtue and ethics and great qualities of sentient beings, the ocean of merit, of fantastic power and qualities of sentient beings, the unexcelled state of Buddhahood is brought about. So what is so astonishing about the fact that whatever prosperities there are in the gods and humans, such as those enjoyed by Brahma, Indra, and Rudra, and the worldly guardians of the world, there is nothing in this triple world system that is not brought forth by helping others. He's saying the key then is to train yourself in whatever you do, even if it looks selfish. This is for me. I'm enjoying it, but it's for everybody. It's for everybody's growth. Yeah. This is a hard one. If a culture is mostly a me culture, I wouldn't be pointing a finger anywhere, would I? But if it was me, if it's really a me, my, I will get ahead culture, individualistic, my freedoms, my liberty, my joys, my prosperity, right? If that's the kind of culture you're born into, then that can become invisibly your default mode. Do you know what I mean? Even though it's not your ultimate default mode, it becomes your cultural period default mode, and it's hard to break. Why is it hard to break? Just because everybody's doing it. You got raised in that. Even if you know better, it's like a swamp of energy over you. Whether it's corporate culture, government culture, educational culture, even Dharma-centered culture, you can go, what? But that's the force of the cultural time that you live in. Yeah? Or parentally, you got to get ahead. You know? You got to make it. You got to beat them out. This sort of thing. So who we are is also very much a product of the cultural milieu that you grow up in. And the thing is, unless you really study your own history, and I don't mean the history of just where we are today, but where we came from. So for instance, we may, for instance, be born a nice Canadian, but in fact, we have hundreds and hundreds of years of Italians or Norwegians or Europeans or South Africans or Indians and or Japanese or Chinese or South Americans, and we really don't know the force of that kind of conditioning. It's big. It's actually really powerful. Yeah. 79. As hell beings, as animals, and as hungry ghosts, the different kinds of sufferings which sentient beings experience, these come about from harming others. Yes. Now, that's a pretty bold statement, isn't it? All the suffering comes about from harming other beings that we feel. It's a pretty bold statement. But what we don't know is the harming that isn't the obvious harming. That's what we don't know. We need a lot of awareness and a lot of mindfulness and a lot of investigation to see further and further and further how sentient beings harm other sentient beings and reap that karma. You say, well, is my ache and is my cold because of bad karma? No, being any sentient being means you're going to get infected. You're going to get sick. That's not always it. But the mental afflictions, and sometimes physical afflictions, are actually due to the ripening of poor karma. I like to do the following thing, it makes me happy, but I happen to be using toxic radioactive chemicals, and therefore I'm now suffering 40 years later, 60 years later, of an illness that was directly caused because I like doing that. But I was causing the illness of others. So yes, there are some illnesses that are direct results of harm that we do to ourselves and other beings. Yes, for sure. But actually, as Namjoon Pusha used to sometimes say, is any sentient being a cold is just a cold sometimes. A flu is just a flu. The most saintly being could get coronavirus. Yes? No matter how much they've done for millions of years for other sentient beings, they can still get coronavirus. And they may get coronavirus. And it might be the most beautiful thing for sentient beings. Any questions about that? So realize we actually don't see a lot of the harm that we do to others. We see the gross harm, perhaps, but we don't see the microscopic harm. That's why we need to get into retreat. When we get into retreat, we can start to say, my God, I'm doing harm by this. I'm doing harm by that. My speech patterns, my body patterns. This is terrific. And how do we change? What's the What's at a relative level, what's the best way to change our harmful patterns? It's so easy. I just wish all Dharma students would learn this.
Developing mindfulness.
Put ourselves in good environments.
Mm-hmm.
Put ourselves in the best environment we can.
Yeah, but there's some other thing I'm looking for here.
Change places with the other.
Intention.
It's so simple. Learn. Learn. You have to learn. You have to learn. You have to keep learning. You have to be a good learner in Dharma. You have to keep on learning what works. And you have to keep adjusting your being without the pride to say, yeah, who cares? But you have to keep learning to make changes in your being that are for the benefit and the welfare of other beings and yourself. You have to be a good learner. So I always ask that sometimes to people who are in retreat. You might be having experiences, but are you learning? This is the key. Can you learn? That's why I really like people to have good education. I really like it when someone's had really good training and education. I go, great, you're learning how to learn. Learning how to learn well is one of the best skills you'll ever have, conventionally and ultimately. It really is. How do you change? How do you learn? How do you grow? What is good to adopt? What is good to discard? Too much salt? Too little salt in the food, yes? But are you willing to learn? Are you willing to experiment? Are you willing to make changes? This is really key. So before we get to things like Tonglen and traveling to other countries and change your environment and meditation and mindfulness and awareness, I don't care. The number one thing is, can you learn? I really feel that the Easterners know that in some ways better than Western Buddhists. They understand. People have to go to school. People have to learn Dharma. Before they go for mystical experiences, good, they need to learn Dharma. They need to learn how to learn. And this is all in all the classic texts, is a suspicion that someone is practicing, but they don't really see the world relatively well. They don't use their brain power. They don't use their intelligence. They don't grow by the mistakes they do and the good things that they have learned. And you think, well, this is so obvious. It is. Just common sense. Common sense. Learning. So Namgyal Rinpoche in the 1980s, I think 1982-83, decided that he would form an academy. Okay, and I had some of the first discussions with Namgyal Rinpoche about this. I had just come out of a retreat in New Zealand, and lo and behold, there he is. He shows up from a trip to Antarctica, and Tarsh and I are in his hotel room with Terry, and Rinpoche says, I'm going to start a school. I don't even think the name Academy was there, just a school. A school of Dharma, but people need education. And he said, would you join me in this? Would you come back to Canada and would you be a teacher of this? So I was going off somewhere else. And he pulled me back. Did I know where I was going? No, I didn't really care. But anyways, he had a vision and he said very clearly, so many Dharma students are practicing, but they don't know their history, they don't know their science, they don't know where they came from, they don't know where they're going, they don't know the history of humanity and other creatures and so on. And yet they're studying, they're practicing Dharma, but they don't have the perspective they need. So I'm forming an academy. That was the first academy. So. Okay, harming others. We can harm others by simply not learning. So you may say, but I'm not harming anybody. I'm a good person. I eat. I go to sleep. I have children. I go to school. All kinds of things. Yes, you can say that. I'm a good being. But by not learning about what really is the finest key points of bodhicitta, we may still be harming and not using our talents. So Anyways, I'll leave it like that. 80. Hunger, thirst, and attacking each other, and the agony of being tormented, which are difficult to avert and unending, these are the fruits of harming others. They're basically saying if you do nasty things, eventually, whether it's this lifetime or another lifetime, you will reap those benefits. Sorry, those activities. So you may say, well, what about a dictator who's a mass murderer and gets away with it, lives till a ripe old age? Yes, there's been a few. Right? Most, by the way, most of the great men, they don't live till ripe old age. At some point, they lose it all. Gaddafi is a very good example. That was just heart-rending for me. You might say, well, aren't you happy? No, it was actually very painful to know that someone like Gaddafi would be hunted down like a mad dog. And he really was, you know, or some of the dictators hunted down by people he had killed and family members that he had destroyed and caught up with them in their life and just absolutely kind of ripped them apart. It was just quite barbaric and horrible to watch, but a reaping very quickly in one's life, even though they'd risen to a height of wealth and power and then being demolished by beings that they had harmed. Others live to a ripe old age. Yes, they do. But look at their faces, look at their bodies. Sometimes you see pictures completely, what's the word, demented, and then reborn into horrific states, just horrific states. So the fruits will ripen. 81. Just as there is Buddhahood and awakening mind, or bodhicitta, and the fortunate birth on the one hand, and the unfortunate birth on the other, know that the karmic fruition of beings is twofold. Both twofold in terms of fortunate, unfortunate birth, and twofold in terms of empty and conventional. So here we have hell beings tormented the experience or the vision of hot bronze being poured down their throat. That's one of the Tibetan hell states, or Indian hell states, is beings having bronze poured down their throats. Very kind of Bronze Age suffering. Today it might be, I don't know, liquid or silicon chips being poured down your throat or something like that. I don't know. Today it would be different.
No Wi-Fi?
Yeah. Being bombarded by Wi-Fi, that's it.
No, by having no Wi-Fi.
Oh, no Wi-Fi. Ah, yeah. You are talking about, I was talking about a relatively good hell state. You were talking about, like, the Avicii hells.
Yeah.
The removal of the cell phone, removal of the computer, no Wi-Fi, right? Being in a place with no Wi-Fi?
Yeah, that's the worst.
The worst. The worst. So you've hit. Yeah, you have. Do you know the Dharma Center is almost completely wired now for wireless? Eventually, they're going to have wireless in the Beaver Dam cab. You'll see. I still feel like sometimes yanking out. We put a electrical cable from the Namjil Cholin Gompa on Galliano Island, a 400-foot cable down to Ocean Wonder Cabin, because there's not so much light for solar power there. But sometimes, you know, I've been down there, I feel like actually just cutting the cable. And the reason being is I can feel the difference. I've always maintained that people for meditation cabins, it's really good to have a time in your life when you're off, completely off, even off electrical mains. It's really, really good to feel what it's like to have none of that. Now, I'm not saying it's bad for you. I'm just saying any room that has electrical fields around it, even glasses do it. Do you know that glasses do it? Having glasses on your face create a charge around your face, a watch, jewelry, all these things. But they're subtle. For some, not so subtle. It depends on who you are. But we will get the Beaver Dam wired. And the Hermitage wired. Is the Hermitage wired yet? Not yet? Sluggards. wireless transformers. Beam. Get put a big dish. Beam up. Okay. Maybe the difficulty with the wireless at the Tara cabin is a certain field or aura around the Tara cabin pushing it away. One bar. Anyways, we find it useful. Okay, 82. Support others with all possible factors. That is just harnessing 37 factors of awakening. Every good factor you have, supporting them. And by the way, some of the support is not obvious. Don't think that you have to be a big world turner or a big star of Dharma. Some of the greatest teachers and beings have only taught very few. They've been so quiet. We only hear about them 300 or 400 years later. So quiet, so hidden. You know, we hear about the big stars of Dharma, the ones that write the books, the big fan, you know, the big ones. But actually, there are many, many great teachers that have extraordinary qualities, but they're very quiet. Protect them as you would your own body. Yeah. Detachment towards other sentient beings must be shunned as you would a poison. Ah, this is a problem of translation. This is problematic. Okay, why? What we don't mean here is detachment. The word detachment here means a slight negative pushing away detachment that is not an even detachment, but actually is kind of a negative life detachment, a gray detachment, a false neutrality, which is doesn't really matter. This is not it. So this detachment is a detachment that has great wisdom and great bodhisattva. It knows that death will occur. It knows that beings at any time, anybody, can be sick. It knows that life can be cut short to any sentient being at any time, that tragedy can befall anybody. It knows these things, yeah? It knows, but it doesn't mean you don't have a heart, and it doesn't mean you don't care, and it doesn't mean that you don't involve yourself in beings' lives, but you know from a perspective of Dharma and insight and wisdom that, of course, sentient beings change, sentient beings undergo sufferings, sentient beings undergo death, and so on, the dukkha. So, what they're saying here is never shun, never turn your back on bodhicitta. Never turn your back on loving beings, caring for beings, compassionate towards beings. Then you'll say, well, what about the tantric vow from last night that says, don't love those, stop loving those that can't be loved? That means beings that are insane or beings that are of such a challenge that giving love can actually cause the harm of other beings. Or you have to wait until their physiology or their being, if you wish, ripens to be able to receive a care. It's another expression for that is don't throw pearls before swine. In other words, if beings are spending their days in the muck, it's probably not a good idea to be throwing them diamonds. They don't know what to do with them. Does that make sense? That's really what it is.
Would that depend on one's capacity to know what to
totally
offer?
totally absolutely. Can you keep caring for beings? Yes, but how much energy do you invest in beings that are actually deluded? and can't actually receive the love or the care or the compassion. This is, there's no rule for this. You have to determine that based on your wisdom. Wouldn't it be wonderful for this being perhaps to go to Kin Mount and give a wangkor in public? But it may not be wise. Makes sense. You also have to be patient. You have to wait for beings to ripen. So there's no rule for this one. The only rule is don't keep putting your energies and your caring for beings that aren't receiving it and don't know what to do with it. After a while, you should wake up and realize they need the care of other beings or other things in their life. You may not have the skills, the capacity, the wealth, whatever it is, to affect the care for those beings. Therefore, they need other kinds of care. Yeah. Or they may not even need dharma. They just may need food, and you're not the best one to give that. Or they may need housing or education, and that's not your best gift. That's not where you should be putting your energies. Do you see? Yeah. It's not so compassionate. All right, some more. So he's saying here, must be shunned as you would a poison. That poison is unlove. That poison is unwisdom, is non-wisdom. That poison is ungenerosity. So that's really what it means here, is that when we shun a being, we won't invest our time and energy where it should be invested. Then we're poisoning. We have a poison in us. I don't have the time. I physically don't feel like it right now. I don't have the means. I don't have the finances. I don't have the time. I don't have the energy. Do you see? It's so easy to do that when we do. But there's also times when we wake up and we're wise and we go, no, actually, the investment of my time and energy is not a worthy, wise thing right now. I need to help them to be with other people. 83, because of their detachment. Now, this is really wisdom. Because of their wise equalness. I wouldn't use the word detachment. The word here, detachment, is beautiful because it means detachment from clinging. So, in fact, the word detachment is the best word that could be used, but for our culture right now, it is not the best word to be used. To be used at this point. Okay? So sometimes we use the word equanimity. Equanimity is good, but sometimes equanimity doesn't give the full flavor of detachment. Detachment meaning separating from clinging. Yeah. Because of their wise detachment, because of their wise equanimity, did not the disciples attain lesser awakening? So here, detachment means not because of their lack of clinging to self, did not the disciples, the Shravakas, attain lesser awakening? That is, they attained to emotional freedom of themselves, but not the awakening of bodhicitta. By never abandoning the sentient beings, the fully awakened Buddhas attained awakening. He's just saying it's cause and effect. You have to direct your meditation, your contemplations, your energy to all sentient beings, otherwise you don't get full awakening. You get awakening of you, or awakening of your family, or of your circle. But for full awakening, it's a different kind of training. Same? But additional. 84. Thus, when one considers the occurrence of the fruits of beneficial and non-beneficial deeds, activities, how can anyone remain, even for an instant, attached only to one's welfare? This is beautiful. Beautiful. Once one understands cause and effect, how can anybody get conflicted about the activity to take care of the welfare, the liberation of other beings. It's beautiful. So that's why we train in bodhicitta. We realize it's a better path. It's a fuller path. And also bodhicitta, the path of Mahayana bodhicitta, also includes the lesser awakening of detachment from self. So it has it as well. You have to have that. 85, rooted firmly. On the bottom of page 8, rooted firmly because of compassion and arising from the shoot of awakened mind, from bodhicitta, the true awakening that is the sole fruit of altruism is the conqueror. This the conqueror's children, the bodhisattvas, cultivate. Tremendous. So this reminds me of going to teachings of the Dalai Lama. 20,000 people. And some people couldn't even hear the Dalai Lama. They didn't even know what he was talking about. And I'd say, how was that? Did you understand? What are you getting out of this? They're feeling liberation. They're directly feeling liberation, even though they don't understand the words. And he's going through a text like this of Nargajuna. I remember what once. He's going through like the root text of Nargajuna. It's only for the monastics. Everybody's sitting there going, how was it? Doesn't really matter. Can you feel it? Or some esoteric point of the Kali Chakra initiation. Do you understand? No. But whatever it is, it's magnificent. So this is really a gift.
Lama.
Mm-hmm.
Would you say that perhaps it would be wiser to give a sermon that the people can understand so that they can attain some type of intellectual understanding, because that could also benefit them as well?
Yes, depends on the audience. So someone like the Dalai Lama, there's a number of them, but like the Dalai Lama has the ability to switch very quickly for different kinds of audiences. Sometimes it's just be happy. Sometimes it's just love your family and get your relative love and caring going for other beings. And then the next 10 minutes, 20 minutes, he switched over to monastics who require different training and a different audience. And I also know, not because I've kind of directly seen it, but also I've been told by those who've directly there. He can be directly fierce and uncompromising when it comes to Dharma, with certain individuals who need to be ripened in certain ways about points of Dharma they don't understand. And he's uncompromising. He's fierce. He doesn't yell and scream, but he's fierce. And so he has ability to teach to many, many beings, because he's also a tantric master, which he exhibits the four Buddha activities. And therefore, he can give the most mundane. He can laugh and cajole and pull people's hair. And that's really important for some people, and hold their hand, yes? And other times, he's very distant, very detached, and teaching in a more monastic way or giving empowerment. So that full range depends on the audience, completely depends on the audience. You may not even be teaching Dharma, but your blessings are invisible, right? For the ripening of beings in future lifetimes. May not even be this lifetime. I've known that. I've seen that. Just simply the blessings of an ordinary laughing or happy conversation, the being comes to Dharma through that, but it might be 20 years later. That's called blessings. And they're completely invisible. Unless you can see them, unless you can feel them and know them. But for that person, completely invisible. Just not even on the radar. And yet, done. But that's because, Adam, it's very important. That's because the voice, the body, and the mind is residing in liberation. So whatever they do has the ability of liberating stuck formations, whether the person knows it or not. And how that leads to fruition in the future is a mystery. But an ordinary person, even if they pick up a beautiful Dharma text and read from a Dharma text, is not the same as an awake mind reading from a Dharma text. It's not the same thing. Dharma texts are good, but actually when it comes from the force of a being imbued with those qualities, then it takes on a certain life. It takes on a certain quality. I mean, giving empowerment is a ritual. But as I said to Namjoon Rinpoche, because he said to me, why haven't you been giving empowerments for something like the last 20 years? That's why, back, it's like over 20 years ago. I said, because until I can give a wonkur that's not a ritual, I can give a wonkur in a class or anywhere I am, like you do, then I'm not going to give empowerments. He said, okay, got it. He said, well, give lots of empowerments. I don't give anywhere near I do. But I was never going to give empowerment until I felt that empowerment is something, not a ritual. Empowerment is something which is a transmission, is a gift. And elaborate, unelaborate. But to give empowerment also means you actually have to understand what the ritual means and not just go through a ritual, but you actually understand that the absolute depth meaning of the symbols and the liturgy and really what it is that you're conveying, and the pith instructions. Okay, back to this. A5, rooted firmly because of compassion and arising from the shoot of awakening mind, the true awakening that is the sole fruit of altruism, this the conqueror's children, the bodhisattvas, cultivate. Great. I think that's a good place to end for today. Cultivate. And I would say just a word of advice. Doesn't mean it's the ultimate word, of course, and I mean that. But when you're in retreat, this kind of retreat, solo retreat, silent retreat, active retreat, doesn't matter. If you feel that you're cultivating a field, like a farmer, you know, or a garden, and you're just putting in the fertilizer, you're just putting in the water, you're just putting in the right conditions, and you're actively there, and you're not over-pushy and under-pushy, and you understand about gardening, farming, then when you're in retreat, you're really farming. And you're not like chasing after meditative experience. How come I'm not getting meditative experience? How come I'm not having far out stuff? I've read about far out stuff. You're actually realizing the most important thing you're doing is cultivating good qualities. And when they come out and when they manifest, don't worry about it. Because often we're the last to see it. We really are. We're almost the last to see it. It's usually your friends that tell you, or if you have honest friends, or your teacher or something says, well, what's your problem? You're looking great. You're showing good signs. Yeah, but I'm not getting any far out mystical experiences. Yeah, but all the qualities are there. What's your problem? So I know someone who can't meditate at all. I mean, they really are. They're probably one of the worst meditators I've ever known. They're really just really not very good. Just because they have no, due to medical reasons, they have no concentrated ability. But they are a saint. They're an absolute gem of Dharma. Altruistic gem of Dharma. And yet they struggle with having any concentration, but they absorb the Dharma and they manifest the Dharma. Isn't that something? May not be the best lifetime for realizing profound meditative emptiness experiences, but it will be a lifetime of perfecting the paramitas, and it's beautiful. It's really, really beautiful to see. Okay, so we leave it there. That is plenty for this morning. We will start at 86. Cultivation, 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 cultivation.
Namo Joshu Du Sun De She Chom Den De Lama Yidam Chosu Se Dam Che Sindhu Dragne Gawa Rajam Kam Tam Che San She Dala Gonsu So Dene Da Tan Kanya Tam Che Ki Rangi sum ge che ge wele du sum sa pe ge wa jene dam do le yo pe ge wa jene nam du te jang chu chen po yi su ro se che ta we gong pa ta jene te she dam ki Isn't it wonderful just to say it in Tibetan and not know what it means? It's actually good, and to actually take up a different language. And even if you don't know what all the words mean, being able to pronounce them and contemplate them and feel them is working your little brain cells. I can feel it. I love it. Even if you don't know what it means, it's still working away there, challenging your brain and your physiology to say it, to learn it, and this is a good thing. Even at a relative level, just a lovely thing to do, and realize you're being worked over in a good way.
have confidence that it's doing something. Yeah. Adios. See you later. Thank you, Nagarjuna. What a genius. Maybe you could. Ariel, is okay? Travis can come before you this afternoon after lunch. That'd be great. Just some administrative things we need to do.
Sure.
Be great.
What time should I?
I don't know. What would you say? Usually when we finish lunch, 3 o'clock. 3 o'clock.
Perfect.
Okay.
Yes,
and
no,
just after lunch.
Yeah. You come earlier.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
2 o'clock.
That's just because Travis has some things he needs to do.
For sure.
Right away. It's kind of like phasers or something. Hasta mañana. Hasta más tarde. See how the brain gets worked? That's right. Very healthy for this one.